Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In her new book, the communication scholar Alison Wood Brooks defines the conversation. She says, it's a co-creation in pursuit of all manner of needs and desires. And when you're talking with someone at lunch or at a dinner party, you're making dozens of micro decisions. It's really complicated because it depends on purpose and context. And Brooks told us recently that in our efforts to get to know someone or make a connection, we trip and stumble all the time. I mean, it happened to her with her own baby.
Charlotte is my third child out of three total, and my only girl. Every moment of her life, of her babyhood, I felt like I was really grabbing on tightly to the experience of it. You know, wondering if it would be my last child and my only girl, and really loving and cherishing every little moment. So there was one night, and she was probably, gosh, maybe 15 months old, and was starting to talk and was just the cutest little nugget. And I was putting her to bed one night, and as we were snuggling, she kind of looked at me and she said, "I love you." And I was like, oh my God, I think she just said I love you to me for the first time. And it'll be the last time that any of my kids ever say I love you for the first time. It was just, you know, one of these very meaningful moments. And I was in heaven. And she leaned in and she sort of kissed me right on the nose. And I was like, this is it. That's it. Like parenting success, I can just, it's over. Everything is wonderful. I lay her down in her crib, floating on air. I leave the room and sort of tiptoe down the hallway, as you do after you put your kids to bed. And as I'm tiptoeing away, I have this little epiphany or this sort of question where I was like, but did she say I love you? You know, she's 15 months old, so she's just sort of babbling and making weird sounds. And then I realized, oh my God, I actually think she might have said, I lick you. And instead of kissing me on the nose, she had licked me on the nose. In that moment, I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is the watershed moment. I have to write this down. This is the starting point of the book. Because, of course, I'm misunderstanding this conversation with this 15-month-old. And it's that kind of little mini micro moment of misunderstanding that happens so often, not just with children and babies who are just acquiring language, but between adults as well. We're tripping and stumbling relentlessly, like at every moment, every turn of every conversation. And oddly, we expect ourselves to be great at it. We expect ourselves to be sort of perfect and charming and charismatic and have no lulls or mistakes or regrettable moments. Because by the time we get to adulthood, it feels like second nature. Like it's this thing we've been doing every day of our lives, and so we should be awesome at it. And when you look under the hood of conversations, you realize, oh, no, no, this is an incredibly complex task. It's remarkable that humans have evolved the ability to do this. And instead, it's more like a train wreck than a smooth cascade of wittiness and kindness.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alison Wood Brooks is a behavioral research scientist and a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Her book is called Talk: The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. And we began our conversation or interview with the basics.
By definition, a conversation is any time two or more people are exchanging words. If it's just nonverbals, you're dancing or just looking at each other. As soon as there are words, whether they're typed or signed with our hands to each other or spoken, then it becomes a conversation. And conversation has a predictable structure and rhythm to it. Because there are at least two people, it's co-created. And because humans have evolved the ability to do this, we take turns speaking and listening to each other, which is an incredible human feat. Just that is an amazing act of coordination, is that we sometimes stop talking and let the other person talk. Even when we're fighting or yelling at each other, we still give each other airtime.
It's one of the most, you say, cognitively demanding things that we do as human beings. And I wanted you to sort of explain, there are two things that make it so complex. This is why. The context of it and the purpose of it. Can you break those down for us, those two?
Yes. So context is literally the environment surrounding you while you're having a conversation. It's the who, what, where, when, why, how. Who's there? Where are you? What's the lighting? How are the sounds? What activity are you doing? Are you rock climbing or are you sitting on a couch next to somebody? And everything about your relationship with those people. Are you close? Are you not close? Do you hate each other? Do you like each other? Are they your family members? Are they your work colleagues? Context is all of those contextual factors that require us to, quote unquote, read the room. We need to know what is going on around us because it should steer how we interact with each other. You're not going to talk to your baby during bath time in the same way that you talk to the CEO of your company in a pivotal moment, disagreeing moment. And you shouldn't, right? Those are very important contextual factors. So that makes things hard. Context changes. And then the second piece that makes it hard are our purposes or our goals. And this gets back to the idea of, like, what do we care about? What are we aiming for? Why are we bothering to talk to each other at all? And humans, in all of our awesomeness, we have a lot of sincere desires. If we didn't, we wouldn't bother talking to each other. Even if it's just to fulfill an expectation of politeness, if somebody comes up to you on the street and says, hi, it would be very rude to just turn around and not even say hello. And so often we're just living up to politeness expectations. But from there, our goals are incredibly complex. We usually want to have a good time and enjoy each other. Sometimes we want to learn lots of information from each other. Sometimes we want to persuade people to agree with us, seek and give advice, keep a secret, claim credit, assign blame. You know, the many murky and colliding purposes of our conversations are this sort of vast constellation of things, and it makes our conversations very complicated, especially when we don't even know what those purposes are.
You write about diving headlong into the science of human behavior, first at college and then at grad school. What was the thing you were trying to figure out? Like, you wanted people to have better conversations because you had seen dysfunction, or was it, like, what was it? What did you want to work out?
Yeah, I started in grad school, I studied emotions. I spent a lot of time thinking about and studying anxiety in particular. And that not the kind of anxiety that you might need to go and have therapy for or be medicated for, but the kind of anxiety that most people feel a lot of the time, or like many times per day, particularly in social situations. And so I studied anxiety in negotiations and in advice-seeking relationships and in many other contexts. And I started to realize, oh boy, a lot of people are feeling anxious a lot of the time. And let's figure out some ways to help them feel less anxious. So that was sort of the first piece. And then I got to Harvard out of grad school and I realized, oh my goodness, it's not just that people need to learn how to talk about their feelings and manage their feelings better. What I've been seeing all my life is actually, and it's not just difficult conversations that people are struggling with. People could be doing a lot better job in even the easy ones. Like, all these conversations we have every day, all day long, with this enormous array of conversation partners, they're so often, you know, boring and or hostile, or like these little moments where people hurt each other and they don't even know it. That's what I think people need the most help with.
You write this, I wanted to ask you about this. You write this in the book, that this new science of conversation, here's how you put it, is the closest we've seen scientists get to capturing how people really are. What do you mean?
So when you think of behavioral science, there's so many methods of studying people that sort of extrapolate away from real life. So they might, you know, studies might have you imagine a scenario and then measure like, oh, what do you think about this pretend scenario?
Right.
Or they might have people come into a lab and play some games together like, oh, let's do a prisoner's dilemma or let's do a trust game that are making assumptions and simplifying assumptions in order to be run clean experiments, but they're really not mimicking what people do with each other or how they talk to each other in their real lives. And so at some point I realized, oh my goodness, there are these whole fields of social psychology and communication, sociology, behavioral economics that have studied all of these topics that sort of dance around the idea of conversation, and very few scholars who have actually gone to the trouble of recording real conversations between real people, not in a contrived way, but in their actual lives. And now, thankfully, I found myself in this sort of digital age where I could do that. I could record people, not just one conversation at a time, but hundreds or thousands of them at the same time.
All right. Let me back up for a second, because I think one of the things that was really interesting was you give this kind of brief, I guess this is the way to put it, the brief history of the conversation. This is the sort of conversation era. So I think people would assume like we've had conversations, you know, as long as we've been a species, but you kind of go back to I think this was the 18th century is where you sort of start digging into where conversation was seen as this high art with high-minded topics. It was the age of conversation. Talk a little bit about that time and how it starts, then it changes and starts to break down and everyone else, even the plebs, can start participating in it. Like, how does it work, though?
Totally. So the book tries to track the trajectory of how our idea of what conversation is has evolved over time. And at the same time, sort of in parallel, how the science of conversation has evolved alongside it. And so in the 1700s, up until this point, the sort of upper crust of Europe had largely been told how to have conversations because there were monarchies. So the kings and queens told people what topics to talk about in what ways. They were mostly to sort of bow down to the king and queen, and they had their courts, right? And that's what they were allowed to talk about there. Of course, everyone else who was outside of the courts of the king and queen were talking too. We don't have wonderful records of what their conversations were like. But on the sort of heels of the French Revolution, people started realizing, oh, I think we might be able to talk about the topics we want to talk about in the ways we want to talk about them with the people that we want to talk about. Maybe we don't just have to do as we're told by our monarchs. And so you see this things cropping up all over Europe. They had these salons in Paris that were largely led by sort of high-minded, glamorous women, which is kind of cool, that came to be known as having these amazing, glittery conversations and were highly, an invitation was highly coveted and everybody wanted in on it. In my book, we zoom in on Immanuel Kant, who was a German philosopher who had lived a pretty Spartan life. He was not wealthy. He was a brilliant guy, but for most of his life had spent time in rooming houses and having these sort of boisterous conversation with local people, and he got tired of it. So by the time he was able to afford his own house, he was like, enough, I'm going to have my own dinner parties and we're going to talk about the topics I like with an interesting mix of people. And the invitations to these Kantian dinner parties became highly coveted. And they had all kinds of rules, which I found very fascinating, because the philosophy that he pontificated and studied was very much about autonomy these thoughts. And then he had these people over at his house and he was like, you will do what I say.
I'm looking at this now. No interrupting, no monologuing, no talking shop, no fewer than 3 guests, never more than 9.
Yep.
And then there was a topic menu that he laid out, too. There was a kind of a you had courses of a conversation.
Exactly. And I think there was sort of a warm up where you could kind of do small talk. Then there was the middle chunk that was sort of serious, maybe philosophy or politics or whatever. But he didn't like people disagreeing and fighting. So that middle piece, mm-hmm. even though it was filled with important gravitas, very much was not about, you know, a shouting match of who was going to win. It was more like, let's reason together. You have put forth an argument. We will try and learn from each other, and we will sort of study it and leave those arguments on the table. And then the last course of the dinner party would be, he called it jesting, but it's just like joking and ending the experience on a fun, positive note.
Well, I love the comparison you have in the book where, so if Kant is orchestrating this, I'm thinking of like a piece of classical music. Mm. You also mentioned the idea that it seems like today it's more like jazz. A conversation is like jazz. And there's this great quote from Wynton Marsalis who said, "Jazz urges you to accept the decision of others." And that seems like a perfect way to describe how a conversation should work, maybe.
Or at least how it works today. Better metaphor is like freestyle rap, right? Like it's even like more current and more improvised and collaborative. There's another great quote from a jazz saxophonist, Charlie Parker, who said, "The best you can do, you know, you practice, practice, practice. But then when you get up on the stage, you just let it all go and just wail." Yeah. And I think that resonates with me, too. So, you know, you've got Marsalis on one hand saying we have to accept the decisions of others. We know there's going to be messy collisions because we're creating this on the spot. And then also acknowledging, yes, and it's this Charlie Parker's point of like, you can prepare for it as much as you can. And then once you're together, you just have to be in it with each other and sort of co-create this thing together.
Alison Wood Brooks, she's a professor at Harvard Business School. Her new book is called Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the behavioral research scientist Alison Wood Brooks is talking about the art and science of the conversation. In her new book, she explores the complexities of human interactions, the history, the mechanics, and a way to be a better talker. In fact, talk is also a framework for building conversational skills. Talk, T-A-L-K, topics, asking, levity, kindness. The idea is to foster more meaningful connections in our lives. The book is Talk. I think one of the things that will surprise people is that conversations don't really come naturally to us.
Mm-hmm.
That we're amateur builders. That's how you put it. So we didn't evolve a natural way of having a conversation?
It's interesting. A lot of my students have so many questions about, you know, what is nature and what is nurture when it comes to conversational skills,
yeah.
Which I get. On one hand, it is remarkable that humans have evolved the ability to learn language in the way that we have. And anyone who's had children knows how wild it is to watch the process of a baby go learn to talk, not just in general, but talk to other humans. It is the thing that it is sort of the project of childhood is learning how to interact successfully with, by the time we get to adulthood, to become even passable conversationalists by adulthood. And as we all know, many adults still haven't really learned to do it very well. So it is this thing that we all learn to do sort of naturally through that process of language acquisition and learning to interact in the social world. But as a scientist, it has been fascinating to see how much room there is for improvement, even for people for whom it doesn't come naturally, and even for people who actually are quite good at it. Some of the most enthusiastic sort of students of my work are the ones who are already amazing conversationalists. So it is, of course, like everything, a mix of nature and nurture, but it has been incredibly gratifying through my own, the research and teaching, to see how learnable some of these skills are for everybody.
You've talked about how students and maybe even others have said to you, when you talk about some of the sort of characteristics of good conversation, like preparing for a conversation with someone, that somehow doesn't seem right, that it's not authentic, that the only legit conversation can be something kind of more organic, that if you're going to lunch with your friends, you don't need to map out a list of topics. But so how do you respond to that idea that that's somehow not real, that's not authentic?
Yeah, I've been really shocked by how averse so many people are to the idea of forethought and topic prep ahead of a conversation. And it all ties into this thing we talk about in the book called the myth of naturalness. Just many of us walk through the world feeling like, oh, you know, conversation is second nature to me, or sort of feels that way. I see other people, I'm observing other people having conversation constantly, and it seems pretty natural for them, especially for the really smooth, articulate, charismatic people around me. I'm like, God, they are just blessed. It's so easy to feel that way, that this is a thing we should do naturally. And those who are doing it well, they're just sort of born that way. When you actually talk to people who are good conversationalists, or you study them, you realize, oh my, there is so much going on under the hood in their minds, not only in each of their conversations, but in every conversation they've had in their whole life. This is something that they've worked on, right? Like, this is a skill that they have developed over many years. And one of the skills that a lot of great conversationalists kind of do, either naturally or intentionally, is topic prep. And it's not hard, and it's not complicated. It's literally just getting in the habit of thinking ahead even a little bit before the conversation is underway. Even two or three sort of little bullet points of, oh, here are the things that we should talk about, or I should remember to ask about, or here are a couple ideas that I think this person will find interesting or productive to talk about. Thinking about that for even 30 seconds before a conversation makes the conversation unfold in a way that's more enjoyable, less anxiety-inducing. You feel more confident the whole time, because you know when you get to those very predictable moments where there's a lull and you need to change to a new topic, you already know where to go. And I think it's easy for people to forget that that's how conversations unfold. Mm-hmm. Even with people that we're close to and that we love and know really well, you're always going to confront those moments where you're like, oh, we need to move somewhere else. And gosh, it'd be nice to know what that other topic should be.
So let's talk about your own maxims. This is TALK, T-A-L-K, T, topics, A, asking, L, levity, K, kindness. Let's start at the top. Let's start with T, topics. Tell the story of Mordo Nachum. I'm not sure how he pronounces the name. This is a story from Primo Levi's memoir. And I love this part. This gets us to the idea of topics. Say a little bit more about this.
Yes. So it was during World War II, I think. And he was a Jew who had escaped and was sort of brought behind enemy lines. And this story is so fascinating because he was incredibly charismatic. Even in the company of all of these people that were sort of his sworn enemies, at least in terms of, you know, enemy lines in the war, he was still able to bond with them and find commonalities and make them laugh and talk about all of these, you know, very diverse topics. And this observer was sort of marveling at how could this person, who on paper is the sworn enemy of all the people around him, how could he be so likable and so successful as a conversationalist, when even in our marriages and with our friends, we're often not able to be as charming and well-liked with people that are supposed to be, you know, love us and feel close to us?
Well, he knew he could talk about girls and spaghetti and soccer teams and lyrical music. So what's the lesson from him that you should just expose yourself to the world, be able to engage on any kind of subject, be interesting, basically, or pick your subjects. Like, what's the lesson there in terms of topic?
I think one of the lessons that I love from this story is that the topic doesn't matter as much as you think it does. Yeah. He's able to, it seemingly, engage on every topic under the sun in a way that's disarming people and pulling them in and making them feel safe and entertained. So the question is this guy like an expert on opera and motorcycles and girls and football and all of these things? Or is his expertise squarely in terms of his conversational skills? And it doesn't matter what the topic is. He's going to be asking great questions. He's going to be listening attentively. He's going to be injecting levity. He's going to be showing people that he's heard them. Maybe he has little nuggets of knowledge, enough nuggets of knowledge to sprinkle in when they're relevant. And I think that's the main takeaway. A lot of people put tons of pressure on themselves that they only feel like they deserve to say things if they are an expert on a certain topic.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot about, you know, sustainable energy. So as soon as that, when that topic comes up, then I'll be a great conversationalist. And I think that is a very dangerous mentality, to think that you only like conversation on topics that you have knowledge or informational expertise. Great conversationalists don't care at all what topic the group is talking about. And in fact, what we have found is the best conversationalists often prefer topics they don't know anything about, because it opens up so many more pools of potential of learning for them. And so that to me is a really important lesson, is, you know, it goes back to this, the root of, you don't need to be interesting. You don't need to be knowledgeable. You need to be interested in other people and other topics.
It's like, it's about topic prep too. You mentioned this guy named Mike, who would always listen to the podcast, public radio program, This American Life. And that's where he drew a lot of his topics. He used those a lot, it sounds like.
Yeah, a lot. He was such a fun person. Honestly, he was such a fun person to talk to. He was so jazzed, just even explaining the logic of this habit to me. He listens to This American Life. And I think a lot of people do this nowadays. That's probably why the medium of podcasting has become so popular, is, and Mike knew it. Like, he knew it from the start. Oh, I have access to This American Life and other, other podcasts and other shows that can populate my mind and my, sort of roster of topics, so that I can bring them to other people and say, oh my God, I heard about this podcast where they didn't map places based on streets, but based on smells. Like, if you did that for your childhood, what would be the smells that you mapped? Right? Like, so it's just, he knew from the start, oh, they're giving me topic ideas. They are populating my topic prep list with good ideas that I can bring to other people. I think lots of people do that now passively. Like, they like listening to podcasts. It's enjoyable. And then it gives them something to talk to other people about. But maybe they're not as aware that's what's happening.
Well, it seems like you just introduce the idea, and you don't have to. I mean, one of the things you mention in this part of the book is the trick is timing. Learn, don't stay too long. No, but it seems like once you introduce something, then you're off and running, at least in a lot of cases, right?
It doesn't matter. Then this is exactly what Mike said about this habit. It does not matter where topics come from. It doesn't really matter who brings them up. It doesn't matter if they are original. It doesn't matter if they're creative. Great conversationalists make any topic good. They ask great follow-up questions. Mm. They are hanging on each other's every word. They're volunteering vulnerable details about their own lives. They're listening attentively to each other. And so the goal isn't necessarily, like, yes, prep topics so that if you want to ask someone how their sick mother is doing, you remember to do that. But once you remember to do it and you've started that topic, you really need to listen to them and be agile and ready to make that topic good. Are they enjoying talking about their sick mother, or is that upsetting to them? If it's upsetting to them, then probably you should change to something else, right? So it's not necessarily about the starting point, but everything that comes after.
All right, let's talk about the A, asking. And there's this story you tell. This also has a public radio, weirdly, public radio spin to it.
Love
this
it.
Terry Gross, of course, hosts Fresh Air, and she is having, she talked to her a few times, but she's having this conversation with Carrie Fisher. And there's this moment where Terry feels comfortable enough, like she has permission, after these kind of innocuous questions, to just ask the most, one of the most intimate questions ever. Terry's asked, did nearly ODing on drugs and then recovering from that habit change the kind of acting you wanted to do? And as you say, it's a really jarring question. But the way she asked it and went about it seems to say something about the asking part of this. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, Terry Gross is an amazing case study of question asking. She has developed her question asking skill so well. And what allows her to ask really deep questions like that, personal, insightful, caring, curious questions like that one, is that she's so good at showing her conversation partners that she cares about them and that she understands them and that she's not asking this to embarrass them or humiliate them or make them look bad on the radio. I mean, this is a very sensitive context, right? It would be different. It's much more difficult than even if she were talking to that same person in private, where sensitive questions are less risky. But even on a recording, she can ask these sensitive questions because she's so good at listening and making people feel heard and cared for. And I think good at signaling to them, hey, if you don't want to answer this, I get it. It's okay. Like, I'm going to ask this. You get to answer. And whatever you say, I'm not going to judge you for it.
Allison Wood Brooks. Her book is called Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the behavioral research scientist Allison Wood Brooks. We're talking about her book, Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. What do you think is going on right now between us? Is this a conversation or is it an interview?
I think it's a great question. I think it's an interview,
yeah,
conducted by a good conversationalist. And I think there are differences. So this is probably, I think I've done over 50 interviews for while I've been on my book tour. And it's been a fascinating study because essentially I'm one side of the conversation is always me. Mm-hmm. The topics are always loosely related to my book, either very directly related to my book or loosely related to the book. So the topics are very similar across the conversations. Mm-hmm. So the only thing differing is the partner, is the interviewer.
Yeah.
And then sort of the norms or the rules of what are we doing here? And they've run the gamut between we're going to have a very improvisational conversation that straight is allowed to veer away from the book content, or I'm just going to ask questions to tee you up and you're going to sort of speak the book content out
mm-hmm.
loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have personal preferences about what's most enjoyable for me. You could make guesses about what's best for promoting the content of the book.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of fascinating stuff going on. You've obviously prepared a lot and thought a lot about this content, and you are a very good listener. So you're asking follow-up questions. You have very good prepped questions, but you're also actually interested in my answers and have follow-up questions. So it's somewhere in between an interview style where you just are working your way through a list and I'm saying things in response, and versus like in those 10 minutes before we started recording when we were really, really off the cuff moving through unexpected topics. And that's really conversational.
Yeah, I've done a lot of interviews over the years, and when people ask how I think, like what it is, like I always say, well, you want it to be a conversation, but in some ways it's kind of a fake conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, I do hope it seems like something real is happening, but I've mapped all this out.
Yeah. And I think, and again, it's a little bit like the myth of naturalness we talked about before.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's true. So even, I think about this all the time, even for podcasts that people listen to that seem really improvisational and really personal and really unscripted, probably they thought or talked about what the topics would be during the conversation. And almost with certainty, someone has edited the conversation after it happened. So whether they took out huge chunks or just, you know, reduced the pauses between turns or took out little pieces of stumbling and stuttering, the medium of podcasting and radio proliferates the myth of naturalness in a way. Mm-hmm. Like even the smartest minds who are being interviewed, we don't get almost any samples of what they really sound like in real conversation.
Yeah. You know, the idea of listening comes in the section where the K part of talk, K is for kindness, and where you write about responsive listening. Talk about how important that part is and how difficult. I mean, I often say what a typical conversation seems like to me is you're just waiting for the other person to shut up so you can say your thing, you know? And so how important is the listening part?
I shouldn't laugh. I mean, it's so absurd to hear you say that. It makes you giggle. But really, I think it's one of the greatest problems that humanity faces. You cannot be a good conversationalist without listening. Listening is a remarkably challenging, effortful, and important cognitive challenge. When you are talking to someone, you are trying to take in everything, all of the information that's coming at you. That includes their words, so the meaning of what they're saying, the acoustic properties of what their voice sounds like, and all of the visual cues. So if you're with someone in person, you're seeing their body language, their facial expressions, their hand gesticulation, how they're leaning, what their shoes they're wearing, what clothes they're wearing, but also everything in the environment around them. It's not just the person, right? Like could be other people in the room. There's furniture, there's nature, there's whatever is happening. You're taking all of that in at once. And that's all part of listening. You're listening to them and to their ideas, but you're also sort of perceiving the world around you. And that is it's very, very hard to focus in on, okay, what is this person saying to me now? And what do they mean? And how are they feeling? And what should we go do next? Our mind, the human mind, was built to wander. And so if you're talking to somebody, and especially if they're interesting, you're likely to latch on to little things that they say and do, and your mind elaborates on it. And then you get distracted and you're thinking about that thing, and you're going to miss pieces of what they say next. And because we all know that it's impolite to seem like you're not listening, we've all developed the ability to pretend and appear to be listening all the time. Like, we always try to make eye contact. We're nodding. We're smiling. We know we should be looking like good, active listeners. But that sort of isn't really what's happening inside people's minds. Most people are quite distracted. We actually studied this. So we had people talk to each other. We interrupted them every 5 minutes, and we said, were you just listening? Like, or did you just hear what your partner said? And 24% of the time, people say, no, my mind was just wandering. And we suspect that's a vast underestimate, because people know that it's rude to say that their mind was wandering. And already, like, a quarter of the time, people are willing to admit, hey, I was just not listening. And we haven't developed great skills to repair those moments when our minds are wandering and when we miss it. If for whatever reason, it feels embarrassing to say, like, oh, I just missed what you said, probably because I was so interested in something else you said earlier, but sometimes because I'm bored with you or I'm not interested in you. But if people who can develop good repair strategies and be accepting of other people when they haven't listened to them 100% of the time, that's an incredible skill to develop, to make sure that you actually are finding mutual understanding and not just pretending to.
There's this part in the book where you write about what it means to be a good conversational steward. And you tell this incredible story about going to this traditional Christmas Eve supper with your husband, Derek's family. This was before you had actually gotten married. And Derek, I love this part of you. Derek gives you this warning. He's like, okay, honey, this is going to seem a little crazy. There's a lot of crosstalk and, but don't worry. He said, we have a solution. And it's such a beautiful solution. Tell the story, would you?
Yeah. He's a very emotionally intelligent guy. Hearing you retell that is so gratifying because he even realized that I might be troubled by the sort of chaos of this, you know, 50-person group was so intuitive of him and sort of warning me of like, okay, it's all right. It's going to be all right. We've got a solution. And so the solution is this Christmas Eve ritual that they do every year in Michigan in the basement with this huge group of Polish Catholic people and their family. It's called the Vigilia Oplatek. And his grandmother, Busha, they called, who has since passed, but she would stand up at the head of the table and everybody, this chaotic back and forth between all of these subgroups, you go sort of yelling at each other and mixing and all, you know, the vibe, all of a sudden goes to a hush. And Derek is sort of elbowing me like, okay, this is it. This is the ritual. And so the way it works is everybody gets a little hunk of bread and the bread has been blessed by the Catholic priest at their church nearby, ahead of the party. Everybody gets a little hunk of bread, and we work our way into pairs, so just one-on-one conversations. And you meet up with another person in the room, and very quietly, you exchange little bits of bread from your hunk of bread, and you reflect very briefly on the year that's passed and give them well wishes for the year that's coming. And you have about 2 minutes with each person, and then it rotates. You find a new partner, and you exchange a piece of bread. You give them these well wishes. And you do this in a round-robin fashion until you've connected with every person in the room one-on-one. And it was so orderly and so peaceful and so beautiful, right? This gives people the privacy and the moment of connection to really share important things that are going on in their lives, how their school is going, what they're struggling with, that they're expecting a baby, that they hope that this person stays healthy for another year, right? Like, this is the moment when you really get to connect with people. And Derek was right. It was incredible. It was what a wonderful way to cope with the chaos of a large group.
One of the things you mentioned early on in the book is how, like, only through conversation are we able to construct and maintain this shared reality with others. So let's finally talk about how do you carry on a conversation? How do you talk with people where your realities are not shared at all? They're quite different. And of course, I'm talking about the moment we're in where you're having a conversation or you want to talk to someone you don't agree with about sort of the reality of the moment. How do you talk about that?
Yeah. Something I have found quite empowering is realizing difficult moments can happen anytime in any conversation. It's not saved for intense feedback meetings at work or, you know, political debates or, you know, enemies finally meeting up to hash things out. It can happen when you're talking to your child about how school went that day, or it can happen when you're talking to your work bestie and you realize, you know, you don't agree with a decision they made, or, you know, it can happen anytime. And in the book, we talk about a model that sort of layers of the earth of all of these different ways that we confront moments of difference in conversation. And I'm using the word moments very intentionally because there have been decades of work talking about, quote unquote, difficult conversations. That's, I think, a little bit of a damaging way to think about conversation. There's no conversation that's like horrible the whole time. These things vary and shift based on from top one topic to the next. And so, you know, even if you have to have a really hard discuss a really hard topic, you're going to talk about like fun stuff or pleasant stuff before that and hopefully again after it. So thinking about these difficult moments at the topic level, first of all, I think can be quite helpful. And then secondly, this layers of the earth model where above the earth, this is our words, our gestures, our sounds, all the things that are observable during a conversation. Even there, we can confront differences. I'm using, you call them African-American, I call them black. And like, oh, all of a sudden we're like, oh, is that, are we on the same page about this? Who's right? Who's wrong? Or we're using the same word. We're using the word status. And I'm using it to mean popularity and you're using it to mean wealth. And, you know, right? There's all kinds of little moments of difference in the language that we use where we have to figure out and kind of come together to figure out what does the other person mean? Are we disagreeing about something? And are we understanding each other? And that's just above the surface. When you get to the right at the crust of the earth, this is where people's emotions are. Sometimes they're observable. Sometimes they're deeply held and not observable internally. But if I go to a conversation and I'm ready to have a blast and I come in with tons of energy and you are having a really sad, hard day, right there, we're going to have this sort of incongruous moment where we need to come together and figure out how are we going to interact with each other in a way that feels mutually rewarding. Below that, this is where our goals and our beliefs differ. I want to give you advice, but you don't want to hear it. You want to persuade me to agree with your views on immigration, but I either don't want to talk about it or I'm not ready to consider another perspective. That's where a lot of our disagreements live, is in our motives, our goals, our beliefs about what is true and what is right. And so I think a lot of people, when they think of moments of difficulty, that's where their minds are going immediately. Below that layer of the earth, though, at the sort of hot magma core, are differences in our identities. And that's right. Even our identity, they're so complicated. It's our race, our gender, our age, our sexuality, our religion, our expertise, our lived experience. And so these beliefs that I might have of what is right and true are intricately tied to my identity and who I am and what types of people I've been exposed to and what kinds of information and knowledge I've accumulated in my life. And so confronting differences at any of these layers, above the surface in our words, at the crust in our emotions, right below that in our beliefs and motives, and then any sort of difficulty where you feel like your identity is threatened,
yeah,
are going to cause these sort of tense moments in a conversation that we need to be ready to navigate.
You do this with students. You try to put two students together to discuss something. They have these strongly held opposing views. And you say they're supposed to keep the conversation going until they can figure out where in those layers is their difference. And so they're trying to work out at, you know, what layer is the real difference. And then you say only then can they reconcile or shift or accept those differences. Mm. So which is it that represents a successful conversation with someone? Is it the reconciling part, the shifting, the accepting, or is it all of those things?
Yeah. When I was brought to Harvard to teach, I spent 4 years teaching our course on negotiation. And it's an awesome course. It's a sort of standard course that's taught at every business school and law school. And what bugged me about it, though, is that it sort of rested on this presumption that when people confront disagreement, their goal is immediately to persuade the other person to agree with them, or to sort of reach agreement or reconcile, as I've said in the book. And that doesn't ring true for me in my experience of the social world. I think there are so very many conversations and situations where we are not looking to necessarily reconcile or persuade each other or reach agreement, but rather, what if we just are able to talk about our different views and learn from each other and leave that difference like on the table? It's like, I just want to hear what you think. I want to hear what you know. I want to learn from you. I want to learn from your lived experience of the world that's likely quite different from mine. I want to learn the hard stuff that you've been through that might make you feel very intense emotions about a topic that maybe I don't know anything about or even care about. Like, I want to know that. And I want to come to that conversation without trying to persuade you or even have you persuade me, but rather talk about it like we are untangling the messiness of a puzzle or a problem together. And we're not looking to persuade. We're looking to learn from each other. And we're not, we don't even have to eventually persuade each other. It's like, it's okay for that puzzle to sit on the table.
Allison Wood Brooks, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug. This was so fun.
Allison Wood Brooks, she's a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Her book is called Talk: The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1, Instagram at Radio West, or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio. ¶¶